This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. Episode 52. And the recording works this time.
Yay.
We did it. Tech geniuses. If anyone could see us get set up, it is alarming that we have our own podcast. It's alarming that it gets out on schedule usually based on how
it's alarming that I can't figure out how to manipulate a microphone to get it to go from a stand to my face in the right direction.
Yeah,
that was a 5-minute process.
Yeah. I fell asleep watching you try to do it. That was fun. Because we are not together.
We are not co-located at this point in time.
Somewhat rare. And then we got on our Zoom call and we started prepping and we put a strange amount of added thought into this one. Normally we just get really excited. Yeah. And then we just start talking. And this one was like, well, wait a minute. What if we talked about it this way?
It'll be terrible.
Yeah. That's so now everyone can tell us when they hear it. It's like, oh, that was a waste of your time. You shouldn't have done that. But we're on step one.
So last episode, we talked about what we lovingly named step zero, right? So if you are in a place in an organization that you have some amount of direct authority over, in this case, we're talking about this from the safety lens, right? And the environmental health and safety lens, direct authority over what types of metrics people look at, over, you know, the messaging to the board, you sit in a place where whoever's in charge of your organization, right? There's a CEO that's willing to, you know, change strategy with you. Like, what would be then the first few steps that we've seen people take that seem to be helpful if you were going to put together a formal strategy to try to move in this direction of HOP? And so your idea for last episode, which I give you full credit, and it was the right thing to do, to start actually with step zero, which is the recognition and the discussion of what is HOP solving for, especially at that level in an organization? Like, why would you seek to go in this direction? And making sure that conversation is clear for the individual that is now going to be the person who is suggesting this strategy change. So that was step zero. Did I get that right, Matt?
You did. And I think that's a great segue too, because that beliefs conversation is crucial and exceedingly rare, I think, to have with yourself. I don't know that we sit down and challenge ourselves to a degree that we would call it a beliefs conversation often. I think we get new ideas. Maybe we exchange old ideas out and add new ideas in, but to at a core level challenge yourself is tough. It takes time and energy, and it's not easy.
And oftentimes, honestly, the reason why people will reach out and say, hey, I want to go down this HOP path has very little to do with a beliefs conversation that they've had with themselves, and far more to do with, hey, other people in my industry are doing this, or I saw some people talk about it at a conference, and it seems like maybe it's something that people are doing that we should explore. And that's actually, kind of the difficulty with this subject is because after your initial beliefs conversation with yourself, the next step, the next phase in doing this for an organization is to have widespread beliefs conversations, because it is effectively a different strategy. And it's a strategy that departs so much from the former thought process that it can be jarring. And it needs to be socialized in order for anything else to start making sense. And that's kind of step one, which we're going to try to explain.
Yeah. I had to ask you a bunch of questions about this because I think to your point that you just made, which was, I think people typically being maybe 51% of the time, I don't know what the stats are, but they
make up a very specific percentage. You know, I like it when people make up specific percentages that they haven't calculated.
Okay, if I was actually thinking about it, probably like 63.31% of the time.
Perfect,
When we are talking with someone, it's, hey, we want to go down this HOP rabbit hole. Rabbit Warren, if you're listening in Australia. And they're really excited about it, but it's, you could see, or they'll explicitly say that it's still in the mindset of, my goal is to get my recordable rate to zero. This will help me get to zero. That's why I'm doing it.
Yeah. Which led you to ask me a really good question, which I think is maybe where we start. You asked me kind of, what does it look like, or what did it look like pre-hop for an organization to set a safety strategy for, let's say, the next year?
Yeah, because we're describing someone who has agency and authority in an organization, and they can decide which way the organization, or at least their slice of the organization, is going. And I said to you, pre-hop, I used a year, I don't know, 2000, let's just say. And like, what would it be like for that person to decide on that year or the next 5 years strategy? What would they do? What would it entail? Who would they talk to?
Yeah.
And you told me a story. And by a story, I mean you made up a character and you role played with yourself. It was incredibly weird to watch on screen, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure it differs for every individual, but the common pattern of what I know to be true and what people have taught us of how they look at the strategy is, I mean, the goal hasn't shifted yet, right? So the goal in most folks' mind would be, hey, we want to make sure that there are zero injuries. Nobody gets injured, right? So that would be TRIR is going to get to zero, or we're going to lower it. We're going to have some sort of goal to get lower, usually based on either a percentage increase or percentage decrease from the previous year, or based on what else is happening in your industry, right? You're benchmarking with other folks and you want to be, you know, industry standard or industry goal. And so you have a specific recordability or specific injury rate that you are trying to achieve. Also true within the environmental space, right? You have a specific number of instances, you're trying to get to zero, you expect to get to zero. And then you tend to look at your data to try to figure out what is driving your injuries. And so, I mean, the only reason I have any insight into this is I used to be on steering committees that would help set the organizational strategy. And we would do a deep dive into whatever injury data we had available to ourselves, and we would try to find some type of trend. And that trend would be based on some sort of cause code that we had put into all of these injuries, or sometimes all the near misses that we've had. And then we would take a look at that the specific set of cause codes, or perhaps the part of the body that was injured the most. And we would look into those and try to create some sort of improvement process or program around it. So, for example, if it seemed like the most common type of injury involved somebody's hands, well, then we would roll out a hand program. And that hand program would be everything from be your brother's keeper and pay attention to where your hands are, to hazard awareness training about keeping your hands out of the line of fire, to having people assess the type of PPE they have available to folks. And you would roll those pieces out sort of on a large scale across a bunch of different facilities or a piece of a corporation or an entire corporation. You do the same thing, like let's say you found one of your cause codes that you flagged a lot was that people were not following procedure. Well, then you might look into programs that you could maybe buy off a shelf that were designed to encourage people and teach people how important it is to follow procedure and routinely do audits around procedure adherence. So you might launch some type of, you know, observation program that had a training package around why procedures are so important, and then a series of observation cards or forms that you would fill out, where you'd have either peers or you'd have somebody that was a supervisor or a leader within a location take a look at whether or not people were adhering to specific procedures, for example, right? And so the strategy would change by year as to what you were focusing on, but with the same goal of, this seems to be the driver of a large percentage of our injuries, and so we want to focus on that and try to reduce that.
And was the thought,
and at least in my world, that's how we would set strategy.
And was the thought additive? Like, hey, from the year prior, we're going to just build on that what we did by adding in this hand program, so that should continue to lower our numbers? Or was it, hey, we need to keep doing what we're doing. So we're going to keep investing in what we're investing, and we're going to now invest more on this hand program.
Well, I'm sure that changes by group. In my world, it certainly felt like it was a shorter term strategy, meaning the strategy was to reduce it. And then when and if the data showed that we had, for example, fewer hand injuries, it kind of felt fixed for at least a little bit of time. And then we would focus on the next area. And then if hand injuries started to creep up again, we'd be like, oh, okay, well, we've lost focus on hand injuries. So then we would try to add in some elements of the program that we had rolled out years before. Obviously, there are folks, I'm sure, that their thought process around it is more sophisticated than that.
I would wager probably most are, but that's just the behaviors that you witnessed and most people witnessed from their level.
Yes. So if that is, let's say, pre-hop belief system thought process, then maybe it makes sense for us to look at what that same type of strategy thought process would be with using a hop lens. And the biggest shift is that the goal is different, which is why we talked about it for a full episode, right? The goal is not let's look at our highest frequency injuries and try to reduce those and put emphasis around those. The goal is let's look at the areas that have the largest potential for serious injury or catastrophic failure. And let's ensure that when we have a bad day, that bad day in that area isn't the worst day we could have. Let's reduce the consequence of these types of events. And the example that we used, if you haven't listened to the last episode, it might make sense to do it because it'll make this part of the conversation make more sense, right? The example that we used is, do you, for example, in an analogy around what mitigation looks like, do we actually have a fire suppression system in place, acknowledging that at some point in time we will have a fire, taking that same strategy, except applying it broadly across a lot of different facets of work. And so if that is now my goal, one, that is a bit of a departure from maybe the way that we've articulated how to manage safety in the past. I'd say that's actually a fairly large departure. And so it could be an individual's goal, but somehow that belief system needs to be transferred outside of that individual to a larger group of people. And so kind of step one is doing that. And then in doing that, also aligning the way that we are acting as that leader. I'm picturing an individual, right? I'm picturing a person who has direct control over things like suggesting a new metric for the entire organization, who has direct control over setting up calls where safety leaders would be reporting into the individual and talking about events or talking about audits, right? That's the type of individual I'm picturing.
And I'll just throw in that you could be maybe in a hierarchical level down below and take these same things and apply it to your group, knowing that maybe you don't get to stop thinking about what you used to think about or track. Maybe this is in addition to, and then you get to do a compare and contrast. That's all.
Yes. Yeah. And so if our goal is to fail safely, then that's actually, it's a little bit harder to measure, right? It's pretty easy to measure if somebody gets injured or not, right? And it's pretty easy to measure the severity of the injury. Obviously, you have to have lots of criteria wrapped around it in order to have some sort of baseline. But now the goal is that we are able to fail safely. And able to doesn't necessarily mean we are failing, right? So this is where it starts to get a little bit confusing as to, well, how do you understand it and how do you measure it? But we'd have to start with, that's our new goal. And the individual would have to be able to articulate that not only to themselves, but to the folks around them and as a larger strategy to the organization. The reason it would need to be articulated and understood is because that person's behavior is going to change if this belief system changes. What that individual is interested in, the questions that they are asking people to supply them with answers to, right? The metrics that they're going to ask people to look at would be very different than what they've looked at in the past. And so that's step one. And then also figuring out what you want to ask people to do differently to begin this change in thought. So step one, articulate to the folks around you what this strategy looks like, what that belief system is, why we're adopting it. And then step two is changing something. And the something is either the questions you start to ask people, like the expectations you have. If you have people reporting directly to you, you know, they're coming in on a routine basis and they are reporting out on injuries. The questions that you would be asking are a lot more around, how is this work normally done? What is the potential for something terrible to happen in this? Like, what's the worst case scenario? What do we have in place to make sure that worst case scenario isn't happening? How do you know that's healthy? Meaning, how do we know that it's working well, that people actually use it, that the defense was designed well, that it works in multiple situations, that there aren't a bunch of exceptions to it? And is it enough, right? Is it enough to actually keep people alive? And how would we know? Have we tested it? Do we understand if it's working? Those types of questions obviously would sound pretty different than, hey, what solution are you putting in place so people know that they shouldn't put their hands in the line of fire, right? So those are different types of questions. So the thing that we would be changing first is either the questions that you're asking, which I think honestly is, it's got to change no matter what, the things that you're interested in. And then if you're interested in something different as a leader, then surely the data that you're asking people to provide you is going to change, which means your metric requirements around this is going to change, because that's where you're going to get your operational intelligence as to what's actually going on. And so deciding what you want that to be, and that could be in a reactive space or in a proactive space or a combination of the two. All right, an example in the reactive space, is what Eric spoke to, which I think they did a really good job articulating how they designed a new metric that allowed them to track, are they failing safely or are they failing lucky? Like, what is it, just by a matter of chance that this wasn't severe, or did we actually have defenses in place, controls in place that allowed us to fail with a lesser consequence and they worked in the moment? That's of course on the reactive side, meaning something bad has already happened and these things are triggered. On the proactive side, that's where we'd be spending a ton of our time and energy trying to understand. That's where the concept of learning teams becomes incredibly important, because it's one thing to look at how do we design something on paper and it works on paper. And if it's purely mechanical, like a sprinkler system, we can test it and that feels really good. But there's a lot of these types of controls and defenses that they aren't purely mechanical and they wouldn't be triggered entirely automatically. And also they're only in place in the areas that we've imagined we need them, right? So somebody sat down, they looked at a process, they did a failure modes effects analysis on a process. They maybe brought some people together and talked about it. And we said, hey, for example, when you're working at heights, we absolutely need to wear fall protection because it's not if, but it's when somebody falls. This is what the fall protection is going to do. And we design that, we put it on paper and it looks really good. But it only works on paper if, for example, the folks that are wearing the fall protection are like, yeah, but I don't really have a great tie-off point for this. And actually, when I try to do this maneuver with it, all of these tie-off areas get in the way. And the harness is itchy and sweaty and half of us don't wear it because the leading edge of this is actually, you know, 15 feet away and it feels like overkill. There's a very big difference between what we think is working on paper and what is actually working has operational fidelity for the folks who are using it. So if you want to think about proactively, what are we doing? We are understanding the health of our process. We are understanding the health of our system, which is a bit beyond, at least in my world, what we historically would have done for an audit. Historically, if we were auditing to something, even like a control, the types of things we would audit for is it there? Do people use it in this moment in time, right? And it would be a snapshot. For example, is the guarding in place, right? In this case, that'd be a preventative measure for people not getting their hands caught in something. We would just take a look at that. Or, you know, we would be looking maybe at something on the mitigation side, and we would just be asking people, did they know about this control? Have they ever seen it work before? And that would be about as deep as we would go. And certainly if we found that people were non-compliant with using something, right? So we had a specific defense in place to be used and we found that it was bypassed for some reason, well, then our approach to trying to solve the problem oftentimes was sort of straight compliance mentality of, okay, this needs to be in place. You're going to do it. And so we're going to make sure that you do it. We're going to audit more frequently. We're going to tell you why it's important. In this proactive way of looking at the health of our system, we have to go beyond that. Meaning when we acknowledge or notice that something isn't in place, it isn't working, we want to take the time to understand why. What's not working? What's getting in the way? Why is it, like, what are the exceptions to this? And that's where this concept of operational learning and psychological safety becomes so important. This important aspect of proactively understanding the health of things. So those are kind of the, I guess, the first changes. Understanding the belief system, being able to articulate the belief system, and then the individual is changing what they're interested in. So the questions they're asking reactively and also proactively. And then proactively, we actually start to change our management systems. So for example, what are we actually looking for in an audit, and how do we teach people how to do an audit? That changes in order to align with this new belief system.
Which is important to add that it doesn't go away. We don't take audits away.
Oh yeah,
we just change. Like, it doesn't go away.
No.
Yeah, we're not saying audits go away. It's just saying maybe what we're interested in our audits changes.
Correct.
Yeah,
where a non-compliance is just a right? Like, it's not the end; it's the beginning of a discussion, as opposed to historically in many places it's been the end of the discussion. You are non-compliant; you must be compliant, and you move on.
And every time we have a conversation in a training, and the group is doing some self-reflection and challenging their beliefs, they always tell us, hey, you know, if we were going through our investigation process and we saw that, you know, they hit this threshold of what we thought was good enough, right? They willfully violated a procedure they knew was in place, or they willfully violated a cardinal rule. We just stopped learning and said, that's it. Check, fire the person. We're done. Nothing else to learn here. Move on.
Or write them up, right?
Yeah. Or whatever it ends up being. Job,
or tell them, you know, don't do that again, right? Yeah. I mean, so, some variation of being like, that was bad.
So period. Compliance.
That was bad.
When we found out there was a knowledge of what the rules, regulations, policies were, and then there was non-compliance, that was enough for us to say, okay, handle the person. And to your point, now it's, non-compliance. There's got to be a reason for it. We should go learn what that is. It just ends up being a huge change. And I want to go back to step one, I guess, which is to have the beliefs conversation with others. And I think it's important to talk about that in any organizations, there's always probably the others that are above you in an organization. There's others that are your peers in an organization. There's others that report to an organization. Having those conversations can be challenging, but recognizing that you cannot change what someone else believes, but you can share what you've learned, what you're changing. You can help challenge them professionally. You can give them resources to learn what you've learned, but you can't always just say, I'm going to make you believe what I believe, is also important.
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring that up as a really good point, because we have seen that in quite a few places. If someone fairly high in the organization has had this belief system change, like they themselves, right, they've wrestled with it. They've thought about what sort of strategy they think is most important. And it's not just an inkling of this is probably going to help. It's we need to do this. If we don't do this, we're going to continue to have some terrible things happen, or we're going to have terrible things happen that have not happened before. So we need to do this. And then the most, like, the desire that you have when you have that feeling is to tell everyone, this is what we're going to do. This is now how we function, what we do, who we are. And leaders are really good at messaging that, right? We're great at messaging a common belief system. We're like, we as the company, this is what we do. This is who we are. This is what we believe in. And historically, you know, we've done that in places, and it seems like it works pretty well, because there's very little pushback to it, right? There's very little, but are we really that? But is that the right thing to focus on? And what's fascinating is, you can tell that there's a need for a different type of conversation, because we can see the difference very clearly in any organization that we go into. If somebody in the room has said, this is who we are and what we will do, and they are someone of influence, then when we're discussing the concepts, people yes us, right? I mean, there's, yeah, actually, no, this makes sense. This is
further.
Who we are.
I'll go
this is
further.
What we do. I support it. This is right.
It's actually different to me than that.
Yeah.
The questions are just, okay, great. How do we do learning teams?
Right. Okay. That's true.
That's
right?
What
like,
it is.
Not even like, I'm it was, not even
yeah, no,
in
yeah,
the
yeah, yeah.
Process.
This is yep.
Yeah, yeah, no,
yep.
No, this is fine. Yep. How do we do it?
Five principles. Yep. Okay. Yep. Blame, fix, nothing. Got it. How do I do learning teams? What do I do? Yep. How many people are in a room? What happens next?
And then you can take that same group of people. You can remove that leader that has said, this is how we're going to do it. And you can say, all right, push back on us. Does this feel right? Does this seem like the right thing to do? What are you concerned about? And that same group of people has a ton of concerns, right? They don't necessarily think it's the right way to go. They're very concerned about, well, does that mean that we don't care about anybody else? Like an ergonomic injury is no longer a big deal. They want answers to that question. They're concerned about like, well, does that mean that nobody's accountable for anything anymore? And we're not allowed to write anybody up anymore? Is that what you're saying? They have so many concerns and questions that are very stifled by the narrative of to be part of this company, this is now who you are. And so our encouragement is that if you're having that beliefs conversation, it's not a mandate. If you're orchestrating what this looks like within an organization, it's a conversation in which you're encouraging people to disagree. Because the only way that we can actually truthfully get on the same page as to what strategy feels right is if we're able to argue back. And we're able to say, but I am concerned about this. Are we really saying the same thing? Are we saying something different? Is what you're telling me vastly different from how I'm thinking? Or is how I'm thinking kind of aligned with you, but I have a few of these concerns? If you can't have that conversation, you end up getting to a place where people are really, really good at lip service. And we've been at places where they can speak this language, right? They know the right words, they know the right phrases, but then you give them a scenario, you give them a real example, and they have no idea what to do with it because...
No, they do. What do you mean?
They only know the phrases.
They know exactly what to do with it. What they did before we got there. That's exactly what they do.
Right. The physical aspect of what people are doing hasn't changed, nope. Right? The way they think the way they think they should respond to something hasn't changed. But man, they're good at saying, yeah, no. I mean, people do things because it makes sense for them to do it.
And error is normal.
Error is normal. And but they really don't know how to put it into practice. And people think, well, it's because somebody hasn't taught them how to put it into practice. And that can be part of the story. But most of it is that we haven't actually allowed the individual to wrestle with the belief system themselves. Because once you wrestle with it, once it becomes yours, right, to take on, you start to act differently. Like the former process of what we would be looking at doesn't make as much sense. And you will have a ton of questions on how to apply it. But the baseline understanding of, yeah, I would have to change quite a bit of what I'm doing to apply it, that's already acknowledged when somebody's belief system has shifted.
I'm going to have to at some point give the Copernicus example. Probably not in this episode. But
you're just giving people a cliffhanger.
If you want to think about
Copernicus,
it,
this is...
yeah, he's the person who's credited.
Your place.
He's credited with... the idea that the Earth rotates around the sun rather than the sun rotates around the Earth. And it was a monumental change in thought at the time. So I'll tell more about it at some point as I work through my history books again, get to use my major
again.
But I think it's just, such a, to me, it's such a great illustration of a change in belief. And it was done through the scientific method, and it sort of helped establish the scientific method of proof and of testing. And so it's just a great, you know, to change a belief that far. You woke up the next morning, everything was still the same. It's just your belief changed, and therefore your actions changed. We'll talk more about it.
Yeah.
Cliffhangers, breadcrumbs, as they say.
All right. So we are so long
on this episode.
Well, you know why? Because I can't see how long we've gone.
I know, which is fun for me because I'm watching it. And okay, you do your wrap up. I know you're
all right.
You're,
just yeah, the quick wrap yeah. up. So last episode, step zero, understand the belief system and decide if it's yours, right? Decide if it's something you want to do as an individual. step one. Now this belief system conversation has to be had with a larger audience, which means you really got to get behind whether or not this is a thought process that you truthfully do think is the right way to go.
Do you believe it or do you just like it?
Yes. And then in that conversation, giving space for people to have the same wrestles that you did with it, to have the same questions, not just saying this is the direction that we're going to go. And then step one, part B, is that we start to align what we as an individual are physically doing with that belief system. And the two examples that I gave are how you're asking questions of people, like what you're interested in them knowing, and then therefore you knowing, and then data-wise, what data you're asking of people for the same reason. Like, I'm interested in something different, so the data I'm looking for is going to be different.
Nailed it. I love how we do the summaries, and it's like, you could have just said that in the end of the episode 30 minutes ago. But just like any good story, you need the details.
So short, Matt, you know?
The details, exactly. You wouldn't be able to run 30 minutes. Okay, so that's it for episode 52.
Yeah.
And we will continue this conversation next time. So thanks for listening.
Well, that's it.
Yep. Another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website, www.hoppodcast.com.
That's HOPPODCAST. .com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.